All right. Well, thanks for the introduction and the invitation to be here. It's a real pleasure to help you guys start off this, what looks to be a pretty cool program. Today, I want to tell you about experiments going on in our lab at UCLA, working in something we've been calling the motion trap, and we'll get to the funny acronym in a minute. The motion trap is a hybrid neutral ion environment. And so what I mean by that is it's a place where we can bring ultracold neutral particles together with ultracold charged particles. Right? Those can be molecular ions, or they could be atomic ions. I'm going to try to give the talk differently than I normally do, partly because, well, one, this is a pretty expert audience. And two, I want to highlight a little more of the motion trap instead of just motivating it purely from the science. So I'm going to start off by just introducing you to the experimental apparatus. And the reason is I want to impress upon you that this environment where you have neutrals and ions close together opens a lot of opportunities that haven't really existed, I think, before in fundamental physics, quantum chemistry, and quantum information. So it's a fairly unexplored area. I think what you'll see as I go through the talk, some of our results were things that just sort of had to be done along the way to our ultimate goals, and they turned out to be, you know, completely unexpected and quite interesting. So after I tell you about the experimental apparatus, I'll jump into the sort of traditional motivation. I'll start by telling you about things you might do with this interaction, this neutral ion interaction, so proposals for things like quantum information, to just fundamental physics of atom-ion collisions. And then I'll end this sort of introduction with the motivation that really brought us into this, and that is to produce ultracold, or I should say cold, charged molecules. I won't tell you really how we do that until later in the talk, but I'll tell you why you might want to do that. The meat of the talk will be this part, which is divided into two parts. The first is I'll tell you about some atom-ion quantum chemistry results that we've seen along the way, and then I'll spend some time showing you data of the cold molecular ions we're now producing in the lab. All right, so let me introduce to you the motion trap. The acronym was basically forced upon us because the device is a combination of a magneto-optical trap and an ion trap. So you put them together, it spells the word motion. That's pretty straightforward. And so the idea is that it brings atoms and ions in contact, so you can look at things like the atom-ion interaction, quantum chemistry, quantum information. From an experimentalist point of view, though, this is really proven technology. That's the fun part about this for us, is that, you know, we know how to make ion traps work. We know how to make MOTS work. They're almost turnkey devices. So we're not, you know, killing ourselves every day trying to get the experiment to run. One of the things I'll point out, because most of you, like me, come from a more neutral molecule background, is that there are some advantages to ions that we don't get in the neutral world. One is, you know, you can trap these things forever. Like, people will literally trap a single ion, and they give it a name, right? Like, and that name is trapped for a year, or I mean, that ion is trapped for a year, and they talk about doing experiments with Bob, and then they go to Charlie. You just don't have these sorts of storage times and these interrogation times in the neutral molecule world. The other thing is that you get sort of single ion addressability very easily. So this is quite hard to do for neutral atoms. I mean, people now do it, but it's pretty advanced techniques. Here, because of the Coulomb interaction, once you laser cool these things, they form a Coulomb crystal. The spacing is, you know, microns, and so it's pretty easy to resolve. So for these sorts of all the things you want to do, you can think about doing them on a single ion basis. You know, if I'm looking at some chemical reaction, I can say, oh, I know when this ion reacted, and then I can see how things go, right? So there are possibilities for feedback that don't happen in the neutral world. All right. So that's the motion trap. Here's just another cartoon of it, just some MOT and an ion trap. Experimentally, it looks like this. So pretty standard AMO setup, lots of optics with the blue light is for the calcium MOT. I'll talk about that in a minute. And here's where everything happens. If you were to look through this window, what you'd see is an ion trap. In the middle are some trapped ions. If you look down this pipe, you can see sort of the four rods of the ion trap, and in this picture, the calcium MOT is on. And so you have this ball of about 100 million calcium atoms just kind of levitating here at about a millikelvin. Yeah. And the reason we chose calcium, well, there are really two big reasons. One is you really want a low mass. So what I'm going to tell you about later is we're going to use this calcium to sympathetically cool molecular ions. All right, but I haven't really mentioned that yet. And it turns out when you're doing that in an ion trap, the sympathetic coolant needs to have a very low mass for reasons that have to do with the micromotion. It's very different than standard sympathetic cooling. And it's actually quite a bit, it's actually a very rich topic. We just had some breakthroughs in understanding this, and you know, they have implications even for plasma physics with something called the Coulomb logarithm, if you've heard of that. But I won't talk about that today. The other motivation that probably is obvious to all of you is that, like, if I'm going to be doing things with ions and neutral atoms, I don't want them to react usually. And so I want to pick an atom that is going to have a reduced reactivity. And calcium is less reactive than, you know, the alkalis because of that extra electron. And the ionization potential is about 6.3 eV as opposed to 3 or 4 for most alkali atoms. All right. So that's the idea. A mott and an ion trap. Now let me get back to the sort of the traditional motivation for why you would do this. And what I'll do is just throw up a couple proposals from other people and give you the references and move on. Their ideas for implementing quantum gates, people like Ivyazek, people like Peter Zoller have proposed ways of doing quantum gates with atoms and ions. This is the Ivyazek proposal where you have an ion and an optical and an atoms in an optical lattice. You can move it around, generate entanglement. Here's just one reference, but you know, there are many when you go to it. And the idea would be, you know, there's some different long-range interaction depending on the hyperfine state of these things. The advantage is the atom-ion, as we'll see in a minute, interaction is very strong compared to neutral interactions.
So the idea is that there are different short-range interactions.
And it is the different hyperfine states.
For different hyperfine states. Right. Long-range is the same.
Right, yeah, that's true, yeah.
But of course,
exactly,
yeah. Change anything,
that's
so
right,
they're
yeah.
Very mad, and then we have to go short-range for it to work.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. All right. There are other ideas for probing quantum gases. So people like Michael Kohl and Johannes Denschlag, who I think will be at the follow-up conference to this, are doing things like putting a single ion in a Bose-Einstein condensate. The original idea is for it to use this as a probe of things, of the superfluid. Now I think people are also thinking about using it as a defect in the superfluid. And, you know, you can look at their groups and some of the references here. A really interesting idea, I think, from Robin Côté, which I think sprung from the fact that Wynn Smith was one of the first people to think about, who was also at UConn, putting atoms and ions together, is the idea of looking at novel charge transport. So the proposal, which is pretty visionary considering it's 2000, was to take some neutral gas, ionize it, and then look at the transport of that particle through the neutral gas. Why is that interesting? Well, there's two ways the charge can move, right? One, the ion could just move. But it's also possible that the electron could hop to fill the hole. If this is a resonant interaction, meaning the atom and the ion are the same, right? And so what he found was depending on you know, the parameter space, one of these conduction mechanisms dominated over the other. One thing I'll just throw out, since there's lots of smart theorists in the room, I think it would be interesting to look at this proposal but flip it around. So instead of having an ion moving through the neutral gas, I think what would the charge transport look like if I had a neutral gas moving through an ion cloud? And the reason you can see here, let me go back, here we go, is because if I laser cool a cloud of ions, I make this nice lattice structure, right? And so suddenly this is more like a real metal, right? There's a lattice of charge particles. Right. There's also phonons in this lattice, which is something we haven't been able to do in AMO yet, right? Our optical lattices don't have phonons. And, you know, I think that's probably a big missing feature in terms of some condensed matter people's opinion. So this lattice looks more like a real lattice. Now you imagine of having some neutral particles here that maybe are BEC or a degenerate Fermi gas, and you look at their transport through it, and maybe exploring the BEC or BCS crossover. I don't know. It's just an idea. Since there are people here that could probably take it further. All right. So implicit in all of these proposals is the idea that the atoms and ion interact with this 1 over r to the 4 separation thing, except for this one quantum gate. And the idea is that, well, you guys all know how that comes about, right? There's an ion with some monopole field. It polarizes an atom. You get your C4 over r to the 4. And compared to what we're used to in the neutral world, this is enormous, right? This is a very strong interaction that can reach out and grab things. And because of that, the interaction scales, the cross sections, are just much bigger than what we're used to. Right? And I would be so bold as to say that it's relatively, especially relative to C6, unstudied at cold and ultra-cold temperatures. I would say a few years ago, this was definitely true. Now it's starting to become where you have to put the relatively part here. And really, before these applications and technologies are possible, there's still a lot to learn. And you can see that by looking at the experimental results right now, just in terms of atom ion quantum chemistry and the ultra-cold collisions. For all the applications, I think that people are thinking about this, the experiments early on have all been surprised by these rates. And you'll see a couple of those here. So I think there's definitely room and need for the theory work here. All right. So as I said, we got into this because we want to make cold molecular ions. Let me back up and motivate you why you might want to do that, because you guys are all think about neutral molecules like I have for most of my professional life. The reason, well, let's just compare them to start off. So charged molecules versus neutral molecules. Obviously, there's one missing electron. There's a net charge, right? But they still rotate. Right, they still have a moment of inertia, some rigid rotor spectrum, and they can still have dipole transitions between these states. Right, in fact, the dipole moments are routinely, close to 10 to Bach. Right, there's a lot of charge separation in these things, and so you can still control this sort of perfect, two-level quantum system, which is the reason that we want molecules for most things anyway. Right, is that we have a two-level system we can control with microwave fields that lives basically forever, right? So all that still exists for molecular ions. And so if you go look at what I call the big four, which are the four main reasons people are doing cold molecule physics or ultra-cold molecule physics, they're all versions of them that map onto charged molecules. So we all know about Day's proposal for quantum computation. Well, there, the quantum information is stored in rotational qubits, right? Those still exist. You have to think a little bit harder about the how you do the gates, but there are proposals that I'll show you in a minute that talk about how to do that. The ideas of doing fundamental physics tests. So this is an experiment we did back at JILLO where we measured some OH transition. It was a lambda doublet transition for the experts with high precision. It was compared then to an OH cloud that was mazing on the same transition in outer space, and you could constrain the variation of alpha over time and space in this way, right? Those sorts of things you can still do. Molecular ions have internal structure, right? Simulation of condensed matter systems. So this was one that has to be modified a bit because most of the things we want to do involve the dipole moment, right? I'll talk about this in a second. It may be possible to recover dipolar fields, but it's certainly harder, right? The Coulomb interaction is overwhelming the dipole-dipole interaction in most cases. That said, though, there's been recent work out of Chris Monroe's group, John Bollinger's group at NIST, where they've used trapped atomic ions to simulate magnetism, right? So, this is usually, like in Chris Monroe's group, it's ytterbium internal state is sort of your pseudo-spin, whether it's in one hyperfine state or the other. Using some lasers, you can couple that to motion, and so you can do your quantum simulation gates. And they've simulated things like a frustrated magnet, ferromagnets, ferromagnet, paramagnets, and this field's, I'd say, really exploded in the last probably year or so. So, yes, sir.
Eric, one just thought came to mind. Have you thought, or will you say anything about ion with dipolar molecules, which is 1r². Have you thought about that?
I have thought about it. Just because I thought about it in the sense of using laser-cooled atomic ions to sympathetically cool neutral molecules, right? I spent some time thinking about the cross sections and looking at it, but that's about as far as we've gotten with it. The cross sections are pretty big, and maybe it's possible. Something like shooting a molecular beam at a trapped ion cloud, maybe stopping some and catching it inside. But the numbers aren't quite as promising as I thought they would be just from the outset. But that's as far, we haven't thought about anything more elegant than that.
It's interesting because it's stronger than 1 of our Q, but it's weaker than Coulomb.
Right. So here, though, the idea is you can recover simulation the same way that Chris and John are doing it. But now you have extra internal degrees of freedom. The molecule could rotate and vibrate. I don't really have any concrete ideas for what that would work, but I just say that to you guys because that's your job, is to think of what would the Chris Monroe, John Bollinger quantum simulations look like if those were molecular ions. What other handles are there? All right, and then of course the quantum chemistry. This is some generic picture I show all the time for quantum chemistry. You could still do that with molecular ions. It's a different interaction, right? So as I said, the dipolar physics is harder, but I think it could be recoverable. So if you think about Eric Cornell's EDM experiment, I don't know if you know about this experiment. He's using a molecular ion to search for the electron EDM. Well, how does he do that? Because you would think the Coulomb interaction should really make that hard. His ion trap has an electric field that spins. So the electric field in an ion trap has to average to zero, otherwise the ion would move, right? And so the way that trap averages to zero is by the vector, not by the magnitude, right? So it's a constant magnitude and the vector rotates. So in that case, the dipoles would just follow this and could still interact. So, I don't think no one has really looked at recovering dipolar physics and molecular ions yet, but at least that's one way that you could envision doing that. All right, so in addition to the big four of ultra-cold neutral molecules, I would say that, there are things in and of its own right that make molecular ions interesting. One is the diffuse interstellar bands. I don't know if you've heard about this problem. It's a pretty big problem in astrophysics that when you go look at something like a standard candle, right, there's all this missing light when you look at, say, a supernova explosion. And that's just because there's stuff in between you and that supernova or that quasar that absorbs the light. Now, most of the time, or a lot of times, okay, that was, some molecular hydrogen, or that was, some iron. But there are many bands shown here that are quite broad that are completely unassigned, right? And this isn't like this is a recent problem. This is that people have worked on this for a long time. In fact, that's how I think C60 was found, is that people thought this might be a DIB, and they were trying to make big things of carbon. Some of the thinking now, they're different camps, is that this is due to molecular ions. And that makes sense because really ion chemistry is the only thing that can happen in outer space where the densities are so low. So you really need something that can reach out and grab its neighbor to react with it.
It's molecular ions and not atomic ions?
Partially because of the band structure, but also just because chemistry gives you molecules, right? Yeah. And then also, I would be so bold as again say that atom ion quantum chemistry is not all that well understood, at least not at the same level that neutral molecule stuff is. And there's some references here. And then this is really what our group is after. There are implementations of cavity QED with molecular ions that look really promising. The idea is that if you have a strip line resonator, you can make a high Q microwave cavity. You can then couple this molecular rotation to it and do all the cavity QED of people like Jeff Kimball, but instead of using lasers as your photon bus, you now have a coaxial cable that you're shooting microwaves down. And so things get a lot easier, a lot more scalable. There are, of course, other challenges, but it looks attractive to us, and that's what we're working towards. Yes, sir?
I'm kind of completely ignorant of this thing, but when I heard it was the first proposal by Andrea and other people in Nature Physics in 2006 to couple just neutral molecules.
Right.
And they said, well, there is a little complexity that if you shine a laser, it destroys superconductivity in the gas.
Right.
But the field of ions is actually quite huge, right? So, won't be that a problem? Like if you have radiation, but then you have this huge.
So I can tell you this. I don't think so. And in fact, Ike Fong built an early prototype of this and used strontium chloride molecules. He wasn't able to get his molecules cold for reasons that I'll get into later. I mean, I wasn't going to talk about it, but I'll mention it, why I think it didn't work. But the apparatus, the trap and the superconductor were fine. Yeah. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, you have laser beams shooting around superconductors, and, you know, but life's not easy. All right, but now let me tell you the real reason we're doing this. When we started our group at UCLA, sort of took a step back, and this is my honest opinion, but I think that other experimentalists will tell you they sort of felt this too. The ultra-cold molecule game is really hard. And that has a lot to do with the fact that you just can't control a neutral molecule at room temperature with the sort of lab size lasers and fields that we can make. Right? So if you think about your normal laser, your normal electric field, you can make a potential of order 10 millikelvin. I mean, you can do more or you can do less, but that's sort of a reasonable ballpark. Right? So somehow you have to grab this thing and cool it down, and then you can hold on to it. Right? Whereas if you think about charged molecules, if I put 1 volt on a piece of metal, that's a 10,000 Kelvin beat potential, right? So it's just a completely different ballgame as an experimentalist. And I would argue that with some of the stuff I'll show you, that it actually is quite a bit easier. All right. So that's sort of the introduction to the talk. I flipped it around a bit, but hopefully you were able to follow it. If you have any questions about that, I'll get into the experimental results now. Yes.
So if you could sort of just summarize some of the things that survive. So suppose you want to study, you know, cold neutral molecules, but hey, they're difficult to work with. So let's, you know, make them charged. So so the things that survive are, so you're afraid that somehow in these traps, maybe dipole-dipole interaction would be kind of hard to recover. So what are the things that sort of survive?
Well, I mean, the things that survive, I mean, is the internal structure, okay. Right? And so that's a big one, I think. You know, you can still have, you know, really big dipole moments. So you can drive these E1 transitions very easily. And, you know, I wouldn't be willing to you know, throw the towel in the ring on the dipolar physics either. I think no one's really thought about it, right? There's just not a lot of people working in this field yet. And people haven't really thought about how could I do this. Maybe there are things you can do with microwaves or with this spinning trap. But I think in general, it's going to be harder. I mean, with the neutral polar molecule physics, you're not trying to beat the Coulomb interaction because it doesn't exist. Right? It's just straight up dipole-dipole. Svetlana.
If I understand, there's some additional kind of movement because of the ions together.
So that is a big complication that I didn't talk about. There is a bit of micromotion, which you've probably heard that word before. And the bigger these ion crystals get, the more that becomes a problem. So what that is I didn't really say it, but the way this trap works is you put RF on this, right? So it's a rotating, people call it a rotating saddle potential. It's actually not. It's actually more like a bird flapping its wings. It doesn't actually rotate if you look at it carefully. That's actually a pretty big lie that is propagated in the community. It doesn't really change things that much. But as these potentials wiggle, the ion wiggles coherently with them, right? And so if you're on the axis, that wiggling can be, in theory, zero. In practice, very small. I mean, in fact, people like Mikhail Drusen are now pushing temperatures into the nanokelvin regime almost with a trapped ion. Right? He's in the microkelvin regime, and talking to him, he thinks they can get as far down as the nanokelvin. But that's only ever going to be true with just a few ions on the axis. Right? As soon as you put more, ions are now forced because of this crystal structure to not be on the null anymore. So there the electric field is moving back and forth, and so they wiggle. And that can grow dramatically. If you go up to a crystal of, you know, 10,000 ions, you could be talking, you know, hundreds of millikelvin to even kelvin on the edge. And so you have to worry about that. But it is coherent, right? It comes, you know, the ions go back and forth, then the coherently, and then the temperature really is sort of the random thermal motion on top of that. Right? But if you're talking about collisions with something else, then you have to worry about that. All right, so now, this thing really takes me. There we go. All right, so let me segue into the experiments and what we've actually done. which really is just sort of a series of surprises along our way to making cold molecular ions. The first surprise was we turned on when you turn this thing on, right, you sort of do orders of operations. So we didn't trap any ions, we just made a mott, right? And we said, well, let's turn on the ion trap too, see if it messes with the mott. And what we saw was that ions started appearing in the ion trap just from the mott being on. So this wasn't all that surprising, because I thought, well, there's a lot of calcium, there's a lot of laser light, we're making calcium ions. But we went and measured the mass, which is nice, and it's very easy to do in an ion trap. And it turned out that it wasn't mass 40, it was mass 80. Right? So somehow we were making calcium 2 plus with photoassociative ionization. And then we spent some time looking at, well, how does it depend on things? You look as a function of Mott density, that was quadratic. So it's, you know, obviously two calcium atoms coming from the Mott and not from somewhere else. We measure as a function of the laser intensity and find that it was quadratic as well, so it's a two-photon process. So somehow, two calcium atoms were coming together with two photons to make a calcium 2 plus molecular ion. Now, this is just photoassociative ionization, which actually Paul did a lot of the theory work on back in the early days of MODS. I guess Lett and Gould were probably the experimental pioneers of this, right? All in sodium. And the story was quite similar. We worked with Svetlana to figure this out. There's, you know, different ways you could think of making calcium 2 plus. The one that looks the most plausible is two S states collide or are photoassociated to a molecular neutral molecule, excited state, which then absorbs another photon to the ion state. You can't really tell if it's direct ionization or auto ionization because the neutral molecule doubly excited state is right here. But nonetheless, we can measure the rate. And the sort of important point here is not so much that, oh, here's photoassociative ionization, but this sort of sets the scale for what you can do. I mean, this is a pretty small rate in terms of what experimentalists can normally do. And the reason we can see it is because the ion trap is just there collecting the products. So even though you might make one a second or one every few seconds, you can just wait 1,000 seconds and then you have plenty of signal. And I think this is one of the nice things about this motion trap environment, is that if you have a chemical reaction, there's a good chance the product is going to be charged, or one of the products has to be charged if it's a neutral and an ion reacting, and you can trap it. And so you have plenty of time to interrogate it, look at small reaction rates, and possibly even look at the quantum state of the product, which is what you really want for real quantum chemistry control. All right. Well, this was actually in collaboration with Svetlana, yeah.
Did you ever play with the detuning around this thing?
We did a little bit because we were worried about the D state, because the things can hang out in the D state. And from looking at that, it didn't look like the D state was involved. Oh, you mean this detuning to try to hit a resonance? Sorry, we did, but we didn't tune it very much because we just had AOM, so we couldn't really go gigahertz. And this wasn't real, I mean, wasn't really something we were too interested in, so we just kind of did it and moved on. But it would be interesting to go back and look at the photo association. All right, so now let me get to the first time we really turned the whole motion trap on. So for reasons I won't bother you with, we started, instead of using molecular ions, with atomic ions.
Right.
And so that's basically, as an experimentalist, it's something easy we can turn on, we can image the ion, make sure everything's working. So the apparatus looks something like this. There, you know, here's the ion trap, there's a mott, the ion cloud. We take pictures from two different angles, and you can do a 3D reconstruction to make sure that they're overlapped and things are characterized and working. So we got all that, got the experiment up to speed, but we got something that we didn't really expect, and that was the gut chemistry again. And let me tell you why that's surprising. The signal, the sort of, you know, raw experimental signal looks something like this. You have some ytterbium ions trapped in just the ion trap. You watch them. They live for a very long time when they're just being laser cooled. In this case, about 4 minutes. This was sort of early on when our vacuum wasn't so great. Now these things sort of live all day. But when we would turn the mott on around the ytterbium ions, we'd see they decay away very quickly. So the fact that they were reacting, or potentially reacting, that's not the surprising part. Because if you look at the ionization potential of ytterbium, and you look at the ionization potential of calcium, you know that ytterbium wants an electron more than calcium does. So when these collide, ytterbium can say, hey, give me your electron, and, you know, it's over. The reason it was surprising is because of the speed of this reaction. I think most of you, you know, everyone speaks rate constant on this room. The rate constant was on the order of about 10 to the minus 10 cubic centimeters per second, right? Which is quite large by, you know, AMO standards. In fact, there's sort of, I would say, maybe not rule of thumb, but there are expectations about what these rates should be, and that is that they should all be about 10,000 times slower, at about the 10 to the minus 14 cubic centimeters per second. And this was from experiments that came out, you know, right around the same time as this. This is in Michel Cole's group, and this is in Johannes Dinschlag's group, where they have ytterbium with rubidium, barium with rubidium, and they see something on the order of 10 to the minus 14. What's more, it's not just two experiments. It's sort of a well-known, I would say, concept. This is from a paper by Kingdon, who is an astrophysicist. So in this paper, what he was doing was establishing this database of atom ion reaction rates. So it turns out astrophysicists have giant databases of these things, because if you're going to go model an interstellar cloud or some upper atmosphere, you need to be able to say, okay, you know, I start off with this, and then this thing reacts to give me this, and you need these rates. And so what Kingdon says in this paper, I'll just sort of paraphrase, says in these cases, which turns out to be this case, radiative charge transfer is the most likely mode of transfer. And radiative charge transfer rates in his database are all set to 10 to the minus 14. This should be correct within an order of magnitude, right? So this is sort of the expectation. But yeah, here was this reaction that's happening about 10,000 times faster. Right? So we worked again with Svetlana, and I'll tell you the story of what's going on here. But to understand that, you have to realize that there are actually three types of charge exchange reactions that happen. The first is what I sort of envisioned all chemistry to be, and that is non-radiative charge exchange. Right, so here are the molecular potentials that Svetlana calculated. The entrance channel is a neutral calcium colliding with a ytterbium ion. The exit is, you know, the electron is hopped. So non-radiative charge exchange is you come through, there's some, you know, Landau-Zener-like transition to the state, and then you go off as an exchange product. There's also radiative charge exchange, which is these guys collide, emit a photon, and go off as the products. And you can think of this as a free-to-free molecular transition. And then there's the free-to-bound molecular transition, which is these guys collide, emit a photon, and make a molecular ion. Right? So when we first saw this, we thought, this could be non-radiative charge exchange, right? You see there's some sort of avoided crossing here. It is at long range and it is quite large, but you know, you're so used to physics that when you see avoided crossings to think, well, it's a Landau-Zener transition, that we said this must be it, all right? But let me walk you through that and we'll think about it for a minute. So this is some cartoon that I probably don't need to explain in this audience. Normally you would think about the LZT on these diabatic potentials, but let's just kind of look at it on the adiabats. You imagine that you have these guys collide, there's this non-adiabatic interaction, the electron hops, and then they go off as a product, right? Well, you can all probably write down from memory what the probability of this hopping is. It's just the simple Landau-Zener formula. And the reaction probability then is just 2p times 1 minus p, because you have probability p of hopping, then probability p of 1 minus p not hopping on the way out. And you can also do it this way, so you get 2p times 1 minus p. Now, what you realize then is, well, this avoided crossing is quite long range, so the atoms are still moving at their ultra-cold temperatures, so V is very small. It's actually fairly avoided, and so the Z is very large, and so this probability is just zero. So when you really run the numbers, what this Svetlana did, what you find is that non-radiative charge exchange just can't be it. Right. So what's going on? Well, it still turns out that this avoided crossing is important because it gives rise to a large dipole moment here. So the way I think about it, and this may just be an experimentalist point of view, that's wrong, but it helps me sleep, is that these things are have big body fixed dipole moments, right? There's a lot of charge separation on this, but there's a small transition moment between them. But in this region, things sort of get, where this crossing is, the identity of where that electron is gets mixed up a little bit, right? And so that body fixed dipole moment finds its way into the transition matrix element. And so in this region, you get a large transition moment. What that means when you run the numbers is that this avoided crossing gives you the large transition moment. You couple that with calcium and ytterbium's dispersion coefficient, their C6 coefficient is very, very similar. It's almost the same. It means you have really great Frank Condon's, and so you have large radiative rates, and there's all kinds of shape resonances as well. And so when she did the calculation, what I found was instead of the normal 10 to the minus 14 expectation, calculated something at about 10 to the minus 10. So just this is the non-radiative rate, this is radiative charge transfer, this is radiative association, and this is the total. So you compare this to the data, and you see that it actually agreed pretty well. So this is rate constant versus temperature. But it's not an open and shut case. There's still remaining mystery, and that is, you can see in the calculation, we expect that radiative association should be pretty important. So about 50% of the time, you make a molecular ion. But we can look for that because it should be trapped. And we haven't observed even a single molecular ion being formed. And that's not just us. There are other groups that have done experiments with rubidium and barium, rubidium and terbium, this is the Cole and Dinschlag groups. And they haven't observed the formation either.
No, Willich observed.
Willich has observed, yeah, that's what I was going to say. And his system, I'll just say that we need to look at this harder. My gut feeling is that it's an experiment problem, because these molecular ions are probably still reacting. In the Willich case, I think his molecular ion is probably less reactive, and so it potentially could stay around for a little while, because he definitely sees it reacting away. So there's more work, though, to be done, obviously, because not only does it impact us, but astrophysicists, they use these numbers and these approximations in all the things that they do. So if you have to, if you change a rate constant by 10,000 times, then your model of some interstellar cloud can change significantly.
What's the relative collision energy in your experiment, the temperature? So it's really fairly warm, right?
Yeah, it's
so
many
basically you bring in lots of shape resonances.
Right, yeah.
Like that old literature from Delgarno and so forth, that if you have shape resonances, that's how you get radiative association.
Right.
It's up, and in fact, that's probably what's happening. In other words, you're making some kind of resonances, and then they live long enough, they can radiate
right.
So you get this nice fast rate. It's a little strange you don't see the molecular ions unless they are reacting. Do you detect atomic ion products, or can you detect? Anything about the products?
So we can, but I don't believe. So we're using these sort of. Standard techniques that people do, where you have the trapped species, you're laser cooling one of them, and you put a little wiggle voltage at the secular frequency of the particle. You're seeing if it's there. And if it's there, it'll move and heat everything up, and you see a fluorescence change. Using that, we don't see the molecular ion product. Now, what we have done since then, and this is sort of under the more work category, is we built a time of flight apparatus that can fit into this, so that in about a month, we'll be able to, with basically isotopic sensitivity, assay every single particle in the ion trap. With almost unit efficiency. So we're going to go back and look at this and see if the molecular ions are there, we should see them. These techniques that everybody uses, this tickling stuff, there are lots of problems with it when you look carefully. And so right now, I'm not saying one way or the other, but I'm worried that the techniques are definitely not good.
The quick question was whether the MOTLAG is still on.
It is, yes. Yeah.
So the calcium photon could.
Well, so you worry more about the ion photon. And I was going to say this later, but I'll say it now. If you think about this, so there's lots of light on it, so you have to worry about the excitation of these things. In the case of the calcium atom, we're laser cooling on an S to P transition, right? Those things have very different polarizabilities. So as the ion approaches, the laser transition frequency shifts very dramatically. So much so that even at like 500-600 more radii, you're out of resonance with your Mott light. And so you can't really excite a calcium atom inside of 500-600 more radii. So by the time they get close enough to decay, if you're cold enough, there's just no probability of them staying in the excited state.
Well, the question is whether you can excite the calcium ytterbium plus molecule.
Oh, you can.
And photodissociate.
Oh, the guy. Looking at that's another thing that could be happening. Yeah. My guess is it's something like that. If they're really being formed and we're not seeing them in this next version of the experiment, it's either something like that or this molecule is reacting again with calcium.
Right. I mean, that does happen in sodium.
Right, yeah.
You make sodium 2 plus and you can photodissociate.
Right.
You end up with sodium ions.
Yeah, so those are the sorts of things that once we have this new technique, we'll have the sensitivity to say things with some confidence. All right. There's no theory yet, but I'll show you the results. We can also redo this with all the even isotopes of ytterbium. This is one of the nice things about laser cooling, is it's isotopically sensitive. And so we measured this rate over a pretty big temperature range. We can even go to warm temperatures for all the even isotopes of ytterbium. You can see slight variation, but it's not much. All right.
Why not odd isotopes?
Oh, the odd isotopes of hyperfine, and we just didn't want to deal with that. It's kind of a pain in the butt, to be honest. you have to have some more lasers, right? All right, so this was educational. We learned a lot about atom ion chemistry, but our goal of making cold molecules, this was problematic. Because we want to, I haven't really said this yet because I haven't told you about how we're making the cold molecules, but we want to have some atomic ions around just because it's easy to like to make sure the ion trap's working, to probe the temperature of the molecular ions. And in the case of ytterbium, it decays in 10 seconds, right? So we have to get away from that. So the solution was to go to a barium ion. And the reason that we would do this is shown in this graph, which I'll walk you through it. Don't worry about the details. On the left are the energy level diagrams, or the relevant energy levels for calcium and barium ion. So in calcium, we cool in the S to P, repump on the D to P. In barium, it's a closed three-level lambda system. And the reason you don't expect this to react very much is that barium plus doesn't really want an electron that badly, right? It looks like a noble gas. It doesn't. Its electron affinity is only about 4 eV. Whereas calcium holds onto its electrons at about 6 eV. So what that means is if you go look at the entrance and exit channels of the chemical reaction, the lowest two entrance channels, barium S with calcium S and calcium S with barium D, are actually below the first product state. So energetically, these things just can't react, right? There's not enough energy for the charge transfer to happen. Now, that doesn't mean the reaction won't happen because look, there's lots of laser lights on, and so atoms spend some time in these excited states, and you have to think about that. But because of that, you expect this rate to be suppressed, and you also expect to be able to control it by choosing your detunings and laser intensities. Right? And I'll show you the result before I go any further. So that compared to ytterbium, barium, we can do something where we have several minutes. And we've even gotten a little better at this now. But nonetheless, you have this system, you can still, again, measure these reaction rates. And in this case, it's not the simple system where, you know, it's ground state reactions. Here you have to worry about atomic excitation. And so what you have to do is go in, basically you're worried about these four states, things like barium P with calcium S reacting. What you have to do is go in, vary your intensities of these lasers to change the populations in the different states, and look at the reaction rate as a function of those excitations, and you can tease out the reaction rate of each individual channel. So the data looks something like this. On these axes are the population in the S, P, and D state of barium, and then on the y-axis is the reaction rate. And what you see is that in the S and D cases, as you go to unit population in this state or this state, you see that the reaction rate tends towards zero. And so what that means is that the level of the experiment these channels involving the barium S and barium D state just aren't that important. Whereas if you look at barium P, you see as the P population increases, the reaction rate is growing linearly, right? And so that means that barium P is the primary channel for the reaction. So you also do this for the calcium. At the end, you fit some formula where you have the rate constant for each individual channel and then the populations, and you do some global fit of all of your data. And what you get are the reaction rates constants of the individual channels at the end. So, as I said, the primary channel is 6P with 4S. And it's a pretty large rate, close to the Langevin rate, about 4 10 to the minus 10. The other, two of the other channels that are important are constrained to be small relative to that. And the fourth channel is more or less unconstrained because we just don't have much population in these states. So the experiment isn't sensitive to them. So there's no theory per se of this yet, but Svetlana has calculated the molecular potentials. And what we've learned to do is sort of read them like tea leaves in the absence of, you know, collision theory, because you can see it'd be pretty daunting. I'll show you roughly how that works. So this state, which we care about, is the primary reactant channel, is 6P plus calcium S. That's right here. So the black line is an entrance channel. The red curves are exit channels. And you see that there are some really narrowly avoided crossings all the way through this mess. So you would expect that this could be a very reactive channel, lots of non-radiative charge exchange here. Yes, sir?
So when you call this reaction, in the traditional sense, do we have a chemical reaction here?
In the sense that, well, as a chemist, maybe you have a different definition of reaction than me.
Yeah, that a chemical bond is formed, no problem.
Oh, okay. Then maybe you wouldn't call this a reaction. I would call it a reaction in the sense that the products before and after are different. So, I mean, I guess it would be a chemical reaction if we saw the molecular ions, maybe.
So primarily we can call it inelastic.
That's fine. Yeah, I'm happy with calling it inelastic collisions as well. Yeah, that's fine. but if you look at some other channel like the S plus D, which, see if I can find this.
Where's this guy at?
Here it is, S plus D. You see, it's not really close to any exit channel. And so you expect that it probably won't contribute that much. And in fact, the experiment says it's, you know, at least two orders of magnitude less important. Yeah. So what we've established in the absence of theory is sort of rules of thumb for working with these atoms and ions. One of them, which I told you in answer to Bill's earlier question, is that short-lived atom excitation is unimportant because the ion forces the lasers out of resonance with these things at long range. The same is not true for ion excitation, because there only the C6 part of the interaction is changing, because the ion's changing from S to P, right? And so you have to worry about excited ions, and obviously, you know, this shows you that as well. And then the rest of the story is to look for avoided crossings. If they're short range and narrowly avoided, then non-radiative effects are probably going to lead to Langevin-type rates. If they are avoided, you can still have large radiative rates that can get you back to near Langevin again. So if you want to find something to work with, you want to look, you want to make sure that the avoided crossings are, you know, as avoided as possible. Yes, sir.
Eric, what is the range of energies involved in these collisions that go into averaging over to get them? I mean, is it the ion micromotion that's defining the energy?
So it depends on where we work. So that's one of the things is we've actually done this at a few hundred Kelvin just because you can in an ion trap. So we're sort of limited right now to sort of 10 to 100 millikelvin range with our small ion clouds. And the version experiment we're building right now, we'll be able to go below that because we can work with single ions, right? And you see the single ion react. Takes longer to do the experiment, but you can get down to, with what we have right now, we could get down to millikelvin, maybe half millikelvin. To go beyond that, you have to really work hard. And right now, I mean, this is maybe a point worth discussing. Like, I'm not convinced that I need to go much colder than a millikelvin. Because what I want to do, and this is true even for the molecule work, is I want to prepare a single quantum state, internal state, real vibrational ground state. I can do that at a millikelvin, right? I don't really want single partial wave collisions. because A, they may not be all that interesting in the end anyway, they're just all unitarity or something. And B, that's actually really hard to do with an atom ion, because the C4 interaction is so long range, you pull in so many partial waves that that single partial wave is like nanokelvin, right? Chemistry is not really what we're after, or inelastic collisions are not really what we're after. But if for the chemistry and the inelastic collision work, I mean, much colder than a millikelvin, I don't know that you win so much, because things like rotational resonances or internal resonances are all at higher temperatures. But that's just my personal bias. All right. So yeah, this was, again, with Svetlana late last year. And then Stefan Vilich's group, who I think is going to be at your post-conference, did a very similar work with calcium and rubidium. Really good result. All right. So now let me get to the main reason that we're doing that. That's sort of the lead up to this. That is, we want to make ultra-cold molecular ions. So how do you do that? Well, the idea and the motivation behind the technique is I can trap these ions even at room temperature, right? Because ion traps have thousands of Kelvin trap depths. And so then I have plenty of time to cool them, right? So how would I cool them? Traditionally, people use sympathetic cooling. So you probably know about, you know, Mikhail Drusen's work, where you have a molecular ion trapped in an atomic ion cloud. You laser cool the atomic ion. It crystallizes, very quickly cools the molecular ion down. But what you find is that the molecular ion internal state is
untouched.
It's just in equilibrium with black body radiation. And the reason is that this collision is so long range. It's just, you know, it's basically two balls colliding, right? There's no way to torque the molecule. So you can say, well, let me replace the atomic ions with a cryogenic gas, right? And what you'll find is that the noble gases, even helium, can relax the internal state somewhat. They're inefficient at it, but they do relax them, and you could just wait long enough. But ultimately, it's just a little bit too warm. It's hard to get below a few hundred millikelvin, and you kind of need just to be on that, like a factor of 10 to 100. Right? So our idea was, well, let's replace the helium with a laser-cooled gas, right? So they have high polarizability. You expect then that these cross sections are large. The quenching rates are going to be even larger. And in addition to cooling the internal degree of freedom, you can also get some translational cooling. Right. Turns out that's not so important, but you do get some. All right. So when we did this, you want to choose ingredients that sort of play nice together. And what I mean by that is you don't want your atomic species reacting with your molecular ion and, you know, causing all kinds of problems. So we made this sort of partial list here that I'll use to give you the general idea. On the left, there are atoms that you can be laser cooled, at least in principle, and many that are. And the first column is their ionization potential, which is roughly a measure of their reactivity. You want this thing to be big so that they're stingy with their electrons. And I've already told you we were using calcium. That's partially because of this list. You don't want to go any higher here because these are really hard to work with, and this one is heavy. So this is about the best you'll do. And so what that means is that you want to work with a molecular ion that has an electron affinity less than 6.1 eV, right? And so here's a list of electron affinities for different molecular ions. You see that of this sort of not exhaustive list, all of these molecules have an ionization potential less than this, or electron affinity less than this. So what that means is if you put them in a trap, which it's easy to trap them because they're ions, right? That's another advantage, is that we're not all that species specific with the molecular ion. Just as long as it's charged, we can trap it. Then they can cool without reacting. The molecule we've chosen for several reasons is barium chloride plus. There are certain experimental reasons, but the main motivation is that it has a rotational transition at about 6 gigahertz, which is perfect for these cavity QED implementations with these strip line resonators. And so if you can get this thing cold, then it's a really good qubit, which is what we're really after. All right. So this is what the experiment looks like. Here's the ion trap again. Here's a blow up. This is a picture of the calcium mod. This is a picture of the barium cloud. And then the barium chloride has been added in here because you can't really see it, but it's been added in by the computer. And so the barium ions, although they weren't sort of, you know, in what I just told you about, we do leave them in the trap at all times because it lets us image, make sure the trap's working. And also it's a nice probe of how hot the barium chloride molecules are translationally.
You ever get other ions just hanging?
So that's actually a really interesting question. If these things react, you can, right, from the background gas. Both of these guys aren't very reactive. Barium chloride is, of all the ions we've trapped, the least reactive, actually, turns out. And honestly, this is part of the reason we chose it. If you think about it, it's a barium ion with a chlorine. So the chlorine steals another ion from the barium, and so you have two ionically bonded closed shell atoms. So it just doesn't want to talk to anybody. But in general, yes, that's true. And I don't think people normally see this, because if you use these techniques for detecting different particles in your ion trap, you'll never see one or two of them. But now that we have this time of flight system going, you can see little peaks here and there of, you know, something reacting with some water or whatnot. And depending on the mass, those either get pushed out to the edges or pulled into the middle. Right? So we added so the way the experiment effectively goes now, even though this wasn't maybe the original intent, is the barium ions are always there, always being laser cooled. So they take care of the translational motion. Right? So this thing is very quickly cooled down. And then we turn the calcium mod on to try to relax the row vibrational states, right? To just pump these guys into the ground state. Well, and so the question is, you know, does it work? Well, to do that, you need spectroscopy, right? If you want to prove that you've collapsed everything to one row vibrational state, you want to go in, do some laser spectroscopy, see that pre-cooling, there's a bunch of lines, then you cool it down, and there's sort of, you know, one or two lines, meaning all your populations here. The problem, which is true for basically all molecular ions, is that there's very, very little spectroscopic data. In fact, when we started this project, we knew two things about barium chloride. One was there was an estimate of the dissociation energy of about 38,000 wave numbers by Bob Field using something called ligand field theory from the 70s. And we knew it would make a barium ion if it dissociated. So what we did in the lab was take a laser, tune it to 38,001, and just try to blast this thing apart. And we just kept going blue until we finally saw that we could dissociate it. The apparatus we used is shown here. As theorists, you probably don't read RSI all that often, but this is a really ingenious technique of time of flight mass spectrometry that a lot of the chemists are now copying, and it was the idea of one of the grad students, Stephen Showalter. The idea is you trap these molecules or molecular ions in this trap. You can then irradiate them with your laser, and then in a clever way, eject them into a time of flight apparatus. So the data looks something like this. You see a blue curve here is when we just load barium chloride into the trap. In this case, there were about 1,300 ions. Then you can apply this laser, and you see that you lose about 400 barium chloride ions, but that 400 barium ions appear. And so the barium ions arrive earlier because they're flatter, right? And the error bar on this is you know, plus or minus one or two. So it's a very sensitive technique. So using this, Stephen measured the photodissociation cross-section, and apologize for this graph, just focus on the dots here and the solid line. So the dots are the data. The solid line is the thermal average for the dissociation cross-section, calculated from these potentials, which Svetlana produced. And so you see that we actually, thanks to this and her calculation, have a reasonable understanding of the molecule now. The ground state is a singlet sigma, and we're dissociating to the singlet pi state, which dissociates to the ground state. Now, this is great. It's sort of infinitely more than was known a couple years ago, but it's still not high resolution enough spectroscopy to prove that you've cooled to the ground state, right? Because this is a dissociation cross-section, you see this thing is, you know, several thousand wave numbers broad. So we had to come up with a different way of doing this, and it's something we've been calling photodissociative thermometry, for lack of a better term. And it works by, well, I can explain it to you by focusing on these two states. So this is the vibration, this is the photodissociation cross-section of V equals 0 and V equals 1, which are shown here in a, maybe a clearer way. So here's sort of the cartoon description of the molecular potentials, singlet sigma ground state, singlet pi dissociation state, and here are the V equals 0 and V equals 1. Now, the V equals 0 and V equals 1 wave functions look just like the normal harmonic oscillator wave functions that you're used to. And because you're driving to this continuum state, all these wiggles make the Frank Condon factor in the integral sort of 0 everywhere except for right here. And so often this is just replaced with a Dirac delta function. What that means is your dissociation cross-section then looks just like psi squared of the ground state. And this is called the reflection principle. And so here's V equals 0, here's V equals 1. You thermally average them, and you get the dotted curve, which agrees pretty well with the data. And so the photodissociative thermometry techniques work like this. If you were to tune your dissociation laser to this node, which is due to the node and the V equals 1 wave function, then you're dissociating V equals 0, but not V equals 1, right? So if you do that, then you turn the MOT on, and it pumps molecules from V equals 1 into V equals 0, you should see an enhancement the next time you do photodissociation, because you've moved molecules from that state. It's like you're cleaning out this state, and then you move these guys down into it. Right? Of course, you have to do that fast relative to black body, but you can see that enhancement. Conversely, if I come to this point at the antinode of V equals 1, when I turn the MOT on, I'm driving molecules out of V equals 1 into V equals 0. So if I dissociate, I'm mostly dissociating V equals 1, and if I pump those molecules into V equals 0, I should see a decrease in the yield. Right? So as a function of wavelength, you can tune this around and look for this dissociation change. The experiment is performed with roughly this sort of time sequence. The first thing you do is you load in some barium chloride. We turn on a laser to photodissociate that and make some barium. Right. That barium's then laser cooled, and shown down here is sort of the number of barium ions as a function of time. And what you see is that those barium ions, this is from fluorescence, so there's some initial rise as the ions are being cooled, then they reach a steady state value. In this region denoted by the blue square, we can either turn the calcium MOT on, which is the red curve, or leave it off.
Right? What's the initial dip?
It's got to do with some experimental stuff you don't want to know about. And then basically there's a laser ablation pulse here and some light. We make the molecules by ablating a solid target. So after then, you know, we turn the MOT on or we don't, and then we fire this laser to photodissociate again. And when the MOT was on, you see that you make more barium ions than you did when it was off, right? And so this is indication of pumping molecules out of the V equals 1 into V equals 0. Now you can do this at all the different energies, and what you expect is shown in these curves. If 100% of the population is pushed into V equals 0 state, in this region between about 43 and 4600 per thousand wave numbers, you see an enhancement, and over here you see the de-enhancement. And the data falls sort of in between 90 and 100%. You know, if there was no cooling, you would just be on this blue line. Now, the magnitude of this cooling right now isn't maybe the most important thing, because there are plenty of experimental problems that need to be improved. The important point, I think, to take away is this. Is that if you back out from this, what is this vibrational quenching rate? What is the cooling rate of these molecular ion internal states? We find that it's something extremely large and on the order of the Langevin rate. Right? Now, that may not be surprising to you unless you know about what the values are for neutral atoms with neutral molecules. Right? So if you think of the John Doyle type experiments where you have helium cooling down a neutral molecule, vibrational relaxation happens so infrequently there that they're able to see vibrational spontaneous emission, right? It's sort of worse than one in a million collisions relaxes vibrational degree of freedom. But here it's, you know, almost one in one, or at least one in five, right? So why is that? Well, no one's done any theory yet, and maybe some of you could do that. But the story, I think, is something like this, just speaking schematically. This 1 over R to the 4 interaction is it's a strong short-range collision. So I have a calcium atom. It comes in. And it's almost like it forms a three-body collision complex, right? The calcium atom is really just close to it. Because if it's truly 1 over R to the 4, right, you know that it would cross the origin, right, the collision trajectory. So once this thing is making this collision complex, it's very easy for this vibrational energy to find its way into this sort of bond. This guy then predissociates and takes that energy away with it. That's sort of, I think, what's going on. And see, that wouldn't happen with neutral-neutral because of the 1 over R to the 4 interaction. All right. And so what this means is that these techniques of making these cold molecular ions are working, and they're working basically as well as nature would allow them to do, right? Relaxation rate is happening almost as fast as it possibly could. And so we're actually pretty excited about this. So let me just summarize, because I'm a little over time. Hopefully I introduced you to this motion trap. You can think about what you might do with it. Told you about some of the chemistry we've seen along the way. There's still unanswered questions here and room for theoretical work. Told you about how we want to make these cold molecular ions, and then showing you the data saying that we have. Before I end, let me thank the people that really did the work. Svetlana, who is, of course, here. Wade Religer was the research professor on the project who had his hands in virtually everything. Scott Sullivan, Kwong Chen, and Stephen Showalter are the graduate students who really drove the work. Thank you.
More questions?
I'm around all week or tomorrow.
When you compared the, I think there were three different curves for the barium calcium system, and they had different scales.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, for the
That one.
So the difference, the only different scale was this.
Yeah,
I tried to keep them all the same because that's one of my pet peeves, but if you put this on a 0 to 1 scale.
Yeah, so for example, the top, it doesn't look like the top diagram does go through 0, but it's, it certainly has that linear slope that you get in there.
Yeah, well, so the point, so it's hard to read these because all these things are coupled. Each one of these data points appears on all three graphs, right? Because at any point, S plus B plus D has to add to 1. And so this point here is this point here. Right, and it's also this point here. And so what I'm talking about is as it goes to 1, that's out here. Right, so that's that point here and these points down here. And so as you go to unit occupancy of the S state, you see that this reaction is tending towards 0. And that has to be the case unless these states are participating in the reaction, because this thing just doesn't have enough energy to do it. The same thing is true for the D, although, I mean, like the error bars are. Okay. Yeah, I mean, well, look, this is actually, I mean, I didn't really talk about it, but as an experimentalist, you can appreciate how hard this is, this x-axis is to do, because this is a closed three-level lambda system. You're solving the density matrix inside of the gradient field of the Mott, and your polarizations are all rotating, so it's kind of a nightmare problem. So we actually, after calculating it, did a series of experiments to prove that we could actually, you know, predict what the SP and D populations were before we could believe it.
All you needed was some hyperfine structure.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't have done it.
So how much, can you remind me how much you know about the temperature of either ionic or either molecular or atomic ions in your trap?
So, yeah, the thing about temperature is ion people use two different temperatures. And unless you add a collision partner, like a neutral atom, you really only need the random thermal motion one, which is what they call T-sec. But when you're adding another body, micromotion becomes important, right? And so that, it depends, is the answer, on how big of a sample we work with. Because as the sample grows, ions are now forced to live off the axis. When they live off the axis, the micromotion energy goes up quickly. So in the big clouds, I mean, you could be talking of Kelvin worth of energy on the edge. Middle is still at, you know, a millikelvin, right?
And this is way far away from something like what Chris Monroe uses, you know.
So he's a single string of ions, right, for that reason. Yeah.
But in your case, you're far away from that.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say far away from the factor of 10, because we wanted a lot of signal to do
but
this
can
with.
You get down to
oh yeah, so that's where we're going. I mean,
you
we have
some games where you know you have these nice, you know, everything quantum with the ions, you have vibrational loads, and then boom, like there's this sort of
we've actually
dissipative games.
I mean, that's where we're going in the next version of experiment, just actually being assembled today, hopefully. I can tell you, we've seen all kinds of cool things. Like we'll have the laser cooling right on the edge of the ions crystallizing. Then we turn the mod on, we'll see them then crystallize. Or we've actually seen the opposite, where we can destroy the crystal with the mod.
And you have no idea how this happens?
We're starting to understand it now. It's been a lot of hard classical mechanics calculations.
Do you know anything about the lifetime of the complexes? Calcium ECO plus complex.
So that's
in terms of the rotational period.
You mean the three by the?
Yeah, how many times it rotates?
Yeah. No idea. Yeah, I mean we could do. I've never done any estimates. We could think about that probably pretty easily.
And anything about the rotational excitation of the molecular?
So that's you hit on a good point, which I left out just in the interest of time, is that this technique is only about the vibration, right? It says nothing about the rotation. Now, my opinion is that the rotation is being relaxed just as fast, if not more, because even in the neutral world, where it's the helium atoms will relax the molecular rotation, the neutral molecule rotation. But we have no data on that because we don't have rotational sensitivity in our spectroscopy yet. And so another effort, which I haven't talked about, is working towards getting that spectroscopy. It's taking a while, and it will probably take some time longer, as you all know.
Erica, just one experimental point that somehow I seem to have lost track of here, but how do you make your barium chloride plus ions, and how many do you actually make in these samples?
So we make them by taking barium chloride 2, which is this powder. We grow little tiny crystals of it. Then we put that in the vacuum chamber and pulse a laser on it.
Okay.
And that pulse laser makes a little plasma, and in that plasma, you get ions. It makes barium ions, it makes barium chloride ions, and some other junk. And then we sort of throw all the other things away using filtering techniques to just have barium chloride.
Okay.
We, in experiments where we care about number, like the spectroscopy experiment, we trap 10,000 of them.
Okay. So the one of these big crystals are plasmas, depending on whether it's cool.
Right. Yeah. But we're going towards the lower end of things because that's where you get more control.
So the temperature, the distribution of vibration rotation is presumably fairly high rotation and moderate vibration. Or do you have any handle on what you might?
Well, I think it's all black body. So Svetlana,
it's all black body.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Up to rotational.
Hundreds. Okay, so the black body is
the black body
basically dome. Room temperature. Your equilibration time for black body is what, a second or so?
Second or two.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, you put these ions there, and they're black body quickly.
Right.
And so a mod conceivably then would change them. You'd have to be much faster than a second if you want to put.
Right.
Them. But it will. Right?
It is because of this Langevin rate is so big.
Because the Langevin rate is so big, so you can actually cool them. So if you had it in equilibrium with the Mott, you might actually have a much colder.
Right. And so that's the reason it's not at 100% relaxation. Okay. Is that, well, I mean, something you might have been wondering, and I'm sure Bill was because he's an experimentalist. I always say this. Let me see if I can get to it. Sorry. Is why the Mott cloud is so much smaller than the ion cloud, right? Because you're clearly not cooling these guys. This is an experimental artifact that we just couldn't get rid of in this trap. So sometimes ion traps have some weird behavior. The next, the version that's installed right now will allow the ion cloud to be installed inside of this. And that simple fact alone will push this to 100% relaxation in a few hundred milliseconds based on this quenching rate.
Do you ever see any prospects of working with very small molecular ion clouds, one ion, two ions, or 10 ions, or are you basically...
That's where we want to go.
Where do you think
that's exactly where we're going. I mean, it gets harder, but in some ways it gets easier. So that's exactly where we're going. This was literally the first iteration of the experiment. We want to make sure that you can run these two things together without killing each other. And exactly right now we're installing imaging systems so we can work with, a few.
How unfeasible is magnesium compared to calcium?
So that's a good question. Magnesium would, of course, be even better and open up things. And people have made a mot of it. It's just not a turnkey system, right? The lasers are kind of a pain. And we didn't want to bother with that right now.
Okay.
Beryllium is the ultimate, but no one's made a mot of that. The ionization potential is about 9-something EV of beryllium, so this would work with any molecular ion. All right, the point of choosing something with a high ionization potential was not just to cool barium chloride, but that this is pretty species independent. Any molecular ion that doesn't react, I can throw in here, and it should get cooled down. Right? That's the idea. And beryllium would just... And you could do things like aniline with beryllium, real crazy molecules.
And if I remember right, magnesium's been cooled even on the triplet intercombination.
Right. Yeah.
And so that means a very cold molecule.
Yeah, so that's another point. If potentially you could go colder by using like intercombination cooling. You can do that in calcium as well.
Right.
Would there be any advantage in working with a molecular ion without a dipole moment so you don't have the black body coupling?
It's a good point. Well, I'll tell you this. The vibrational splitting of barium chloride is 330 wave numbers, which is basically the peak of room temperature black body.
It's KT.
Right, that's almost as worse. the mot can still overwhelm it, right? It would be interesting, but as soon as you do that, then these applications as qubits go away, right? So there probably is a better choice that still has a dipole moment,
MGH plus or something.
So going back to the sort of long-term visions that you planned in the beginning, which ones do you think are feasible and which are among your goals?
Well, I mean, for now, we're really staying with the molecular ion stuff and not really looking at the atom ion stuff. There are other people doing that, and I think we'll do it all, more or less, with some sort of tweaking. People like Michel Kuhl's group and Johannes Stimmschlag's group doing single ions in a BEC. They're going to run into some problem because they have rubidium, and that's heavy, and eventually that's going to nip at them because of these effects I didn't get to talk to, but other than that, they're really going forward. For us, I mean, I guess my honest opinion, and this is really my truthful opinion, is I think all the things are on the table right now. I mean, if you think about this, we've been doing this for 4.5 years, starting from an empty lab, right, when I went to UCLA. And now we're cooling the molecular ions. Like, that's so much easier than all the things that I've done over the previous 10 years with neutral molecules, right? It's sort of, we did more in a few years than I feel like I've done in the rest of my life. So I think that there's a lot to do in the system, and I honestly believe it's just gonna work. Especially this, the one thing is that we're gonna, I think, unless someone really smart comes up with some ideas, you're gonna always be working with small ion numbers for the real precision stuff.
So for the small molecular ion numbers, how are you going to do the detection? Fluorescent with the cycle of the atom in the transition, or for barium chloride, you wouldn't be able to do that. Right?
Yeah, so there's sort of two tactics we have. One is when you're working with small ion numbers, and you've probably seen this work, Drewson really showed how to do this, you'll see your ion move, because of a dark ion, right? That's not as pleasing because it's somewhat indirect.
It's also not quantum state selective.
Right, right. So the quantum state, oh, the quantum state selective part. Look, the other way is this time of flight apparatus is now being added to the motion trap.
It's so destructive.
Right, but it's destructive. So we would still be right now destructive with the detection, but we can get quantum state selective once we get rotational spectroscopy, because we can drive. I mean, the plan for the experiment is, you know, in the next version is once we've proven the rotational cooling, to then start driving the rotational transition and doing like a double resonance experiment. So drive, you know, Robbie flopping on this and measure it with the photodissociation laser, right?
Right,
but in the longer term, once you have it next to the strip line resonator, then it's easy. You can see on the microwave bus.
Yeah.
But I mean, easy, once you have it in this, that's down the road. Yeah. Oh yeah, more than 5 years away. But I think in the meantime, this destructive stuff is probably okay.
It's still for small, you know, when you talk about 10 ions, it would still be different.
Well, so it would be, except for this time of flight technique that this kid, Steven, invented. We can literally see a single ion in the trap,
yeah.
And we know exactly, we know its mass to within the isotope. So it's, I don't know, that really changed the way we do physics once that came along.
Right.
So,
can I make one point on the spectroscopy? Of course, you can, if you have very few ions, you can try some quantum spectroscopy using the other ion to read it, but okay, that might be common.
So there are people doing that. So Kim Brown at Georgia Tech and Brian Odom have talked about the sun, this sort of analog of the NIST quantum logic spectroscopy. So they're doing that with sort of calcium ions with calcium hydride molecules.
It's difficult, but
yeah.
It's a non-destructive
right,
way.
Right. That's definitely true. I mean, right now we're really thinking destructive because it seems to be easier. I mean, we would like to have a cycling transition or to be able to look at fluorescence, but we have so few. So it just makes more sense right now to convert that barium chloride into a barium. And we can see that single barium ion appear. And that's sort of the best sensitivity.
The question that I have more in mind is that, so you said that now we have like 10,000?
Oh, I know. I mean, that's sort of that. This was more like 1,000 probably here. We work with sort of 100 is sort of typical. And we're pushing down.
But to push it down to?
To one or two. I mean, or 10.
But you plan to keep the...
Keep the barium. Yeah. Okay. So maybe two. Barium ion and barium chloride. No. It's a good point. Because even two is dramatically different than one. Right. Yeah.
Because I mean, it's one of the things that you are interested in. If you have mixed species, so if you are using, you are cooling, let's say the barium one, how that would help to cool the other. So when you are in very small numbers.
Right. And very small numbers. In large numbers, we've recently. Work this out in terms of sort of a plasma physics point of view and use this to measure something called the Coulomb logarithm. It has to do with screening of charges in plasmas. And there we actually can write down very simple analytical equations that tell you basically the thermodynamics of the ions in the trap. It's pretty, but I could tell you more about that. It'd be interesting to see how that goes when you go to small number. Stella?
Is there any plans for real
games,
like
Camarilla
Lion, Camarilla?
So, I would like to do some of the molecular ions that hang out in these interstellar clouds. So things like H3+ or NH3+. Those will be very reactive, though. And so with calcium, my intuition is that they'll just quickly react with calcium. Now, we still want to try that, simply because it really shouldn't be that hard. Once you get them in the trap, you know, we can have something else in there that we laser cool and get them at least code translationally, and then we just watch the reaction happen. Beyond that, I don't know right now, because most real molecules will react with almost any laser coolable ion, except for maybe magnesium or beryllium. But yeah, that's something we definitely would like to see, because I mean you could trap graphene if you wanted, right? And see what, I mean, you can trap anything in these things. And so I think that's some of the excitement, is that there's many directions you can go right now. We're trying to figure out.
Just another thought, not that, it's this is another direction, going back to the earlier part of your talk. I think this is kind of picking up on one of the earlier questions, but if Zoller had these ideas about molecular dipolar crystals and things like that,
right, yeah.
Problem with ions and stuff, but you were talking about taking ion clouds and moving neutral atom clouds through them, but you could also have molecular dipolar crystals, or molecular dipolar ordered arrays of some kind in lattices with one or more ions, and how might they get together? That's right. Kind of exotic,
yeah,
and maybe a little much further down the line perhaps than what you're doing, but I'm just wondering if ions with arrays of dipoles, molecular, real molecular dipoles in lattices, say, would ever be, do something interesting.
So the here's the thing that you have to beat for this, but I think you can beat it. Is that the electric field is averaging to zero, right? So this electric field is going, psh, psh. So the dipole, if it can.
That's in the ion trap.
Right, it is doing like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the square of the electric field doesn't average to zero. And so perhaps the ions do track each other, right? But if you're really down in the part where the dipole moment's still turning on, I think it ends up, the effect gets averaged over this small region, and it's pretty small. I don't know. I mean, there may be different geometries for traps where you can have something like a rotating electric field that you can cover this.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, these are the sorts of things that we talk about, but you know, we've never really gotten anywhere with them.
Okay.
But you're a lot smarter than me, Paul, so I'm sure that you can.
Okay. If there are no more questions, Eric will be around through tomorrow, so just catch him and ask questions. And see you in the morning. It's time for cookies, I think.